Hello.
And welcome back
to
This Is Not
a History
Lecture.
Whew. It is episode 160, which yes. Means we've got a little bit of a theme for y'all.
Yes, we do. And it's somewhat related to a previous week.
Mm-hmm.
We had talked about the Chicago World's Fair before.
Mm-hmm.
So this week's theme of serial killers who kind of are or are not serial killers
mm-hmm.
is starting, well, this week, I guess it'll start with you. So do you want to go first?
So I will be talking about today none other than Elizabeth Bathory.
Yes.
Or if we're being pronunciation language correct, Erzabet, which is not really how you pronounce that, but it's
we'll
like,
take it, but yeah, we'll take it.
It's
yeah,
what I'm going to do today. Mm-hmm.
And in line with mine from my topic from a couple weeks ago, I will be discussing H.H. Holmes.
Mm.
We're flipping it on its head in our order this week because my topic's a little bit longer. So mm-hmm. I think we're going to start with Cal so that she can knock hers out. And then I will do part one of mine this week and we'll start with part two of mine next week.
Awesome. Cool.
And that does mean that we'll have to push back what we pre-recorded for next week. So if there's anything on in 2 weeks from now about how it was episode 161, we are changing that. It is now episode 162.
That's wrong. We were wrong. See?
Yes.
It's all about correcting your mistakes.
Yes.
And what we once believed was true is not true anymore.
Which is a great way to start off this week's topic, and stick around to find out why.
This is not a history lecture with Kat and Kaylee.
Okay. So if you just heard a bump.
That was Mouse.
That was Mouse. She wanted to be on the episode too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we are going to be debunking mm-hmm. some serial killers this week.
Yeah.
Not totally, but we're going to hopefully change the way that people think about them from mm-hmm. the misconceptions that have been built up through time.
Yeah, for sure. So Elizabeth Bathory is probably one of the most notorious women in history.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't heard of her, you've likely heard of Bloody Mary,
mm-hmm.
which is in part from her. It's not the direct like connection to the legend, but a lot of people like to say like, oh, there was this lady who bathed in the blood of virgins and
mm-hmm.
that's Bloody Mary. That's who you're talking to. But so it's kind of like you see her name come up in connection with legend a lot. And we'll get into why, because a lot of her life is just kind of legend, and we can't prove a whole lot of it. But that doesn't mean that she didn't exist, and that she didn't probably do some pretty bad stuff. So let's get into it.
Yes, I'm so ready.
Yes. So Bathory was born in Hungary in the town of Nyír Bátor on August 7th, 1560. When I tell you, this lady was like, came from the elite. She came from the elite.
The 1%.
Yes. Like, her family was richer than, like, the king of Hungary.
Oh.
Yes.
So, like, we're talking, like, French levels of aristocracy
yes.
here.
Like, okay. They had money.
Isn't it funny? In a rich man's world?
She herself was a countess. And so she was not only, you know, had the money, but she also had the title to back herself up. And her parents were Baron George the sixth of Bathory and Baroness Anna Bathory. The king of Poland was in their family.
Oh, wow.
And the prince of Transylvania was in her family. So, like, these people are very, very, very well connected. Now, because of how notorious she would become, a lot of people like to try to look at her early life and be like, well, that's why she killed all those people. Well, that's why she killed all those people. Mm-hmm. Well, that's like, and like,
they want to build the story themselves.
Yes. And for what we have seen, none of it is really true. She seemed to lead like a pretty regular, just kind of like average life that you would expect, like, of a very wealthy child of a nobility, you know.
Okay.
Actually, she benefited from, apparently there was an idea at the time where it was like kind of fashionable to educate women just as much as you educated men when they were growing up. So she kind of landed right in that sweet spot when that was like the thing to do. And so she received a really good education for a woman of her time, even of her status, and like seemed to have a pretty good life before. Now, there is like one of the most popular like parts of this legend is that her parents were really inbred, so severely inbred that like that
it created
like maybe some mental handicaps for her, and that would lead to that. But from what I saw and what some articles were saying, yes, they were related, but in no way were they so closely related. But it was even taboo for like back then.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole inbred narrative seems just kind of be like people again trying to like be like, well, that's why she was like that, because her parents were really inbred, or she was really inbred.
The human psychology, like the need to explain things instead of just being like she was a bad person is like really interesting.
Yeah, because she can just be a bad person, guys. It happens. People are bad people.
And I think people are more willing to look at women
like
in history that way. Like, oh, she must have had a reason for it. Sometimes people are just bad.
Uh-huh. And that includes women. So, she was prone to seizures as a child, and she did have epilepsy, which is, again, thought to be caused by the inbreeding, the supposed alleged inbreeding.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm not denying that she had seizures, because a lot of kids do have difficulties with seizures as they are when they're younger. But we just cannot say if it was for one reason or another. I mean, maybe she was getting like the well had too many heavy metals in it, and that was like throwing her brain off when she was drinking the water. You know, like you can't really say why. And apparently a lot of like the treatments that went into like trying to treat her as a girl had a lot to do with things like garlic and silver and those kinds of things, which, as we'll get into later, will all kind of influence none other than the creation of like vampires. So at 11, so her parents died when she was I think 10 years old, and at the age of 11 she was engaged to Count Ferenc Nadaste, Nadasti, and he was only like 4 years older than her, so not bad. So she was 11, he was 15, which is still weird, but
wow, it could have been a lot worse, 20s or 30s.
Exactly. The two got married when she was 15. On May 8th of 1575.
Oh, okay, so they waited a little bit. More than I expected.
Yes. And apparently his Ferenc's wedding gift to Elizabeth was his household, the castle of, oh God, I cannot pronounce Hungarian, Szegete, which was on the lower end of the Carpathian Mountains. So very, very kind of idyllic spot for a castle in the mountains. Now, Ferenc, because again, these are nobles, they're not like, you know, the kings and queens, but they're pretty high up in the military, or high up in the nobility. So he didn't have like a job given to him, but he was eventually, a couple years into their marriage, promoted to be the chief commander of the Hungarian troops, and was like basically absent for most of their marriage because he was sent off to fight against the war with the Ottoman Empire. Now, there are also a lot of rumors about this couple and their relationship, because for whatever reason, their first child was not born until 10 years after they got married. And now she was 15 when they got married, so they could have very easily had a kid.
Interesting.
Like, you know, year one. but they didn't. This has kind of been the source of a lot of speculation about her possibly being gay or a lesbian or bisexual or having some sort of sexual attraction to women. And it's thought that some of later on the abuses she committed against young girls and having kind of girls and adolescent women as her target might have been her kind of like coping with the manifestations of her own sexuality.
I mean, I firmly believe that if you don't have children by the time you're 16, you are
infected. Or if your husband spends most of his time at war, and then maybe you never really liked each other to begin with, so you're not really like that excited.
See that as the only option.
Yeah.
For those of you who can't see my face or can't hear it over the mic, I'm being extremely sarcastic.
Yes. Yeah. So, of course, people love to speculate, and they love to be like, well, that's why, mm-hmm. About people in the past, and we just can't say that. But I wanted to acknowledge it because it is part of, like, the legend that comes out of Elizabeth Bathory and kind of the all of these things that people like to put on her, mm-hmm. and these ideas that they like to be like, well, that's why. Well, that's why. Mm-hmm. And then there's also kind of, like, to me, and that part of it, like, lesbians, I think, for a long time have had to deal with the idea that they're predatory, you know, in the same way that, like, gay men can be seen as predatory. And so having a woman who supposedly killed dozens of young women, mm-hmm. and then also didn't have a baby until 10 years into her marriage, it kind of makes it easy for people to be like, ah, yeah, see, those predatory lesbians, see? Mm-hmm. Yeah, she obviously was dealing with something. So, yeah, there's also rumors that maybe he was gay, and that's why they didn't have a kid for a long time, and that's maybe also why he spent so much time in the military, because he was, you know, more interested in male company.
I would more readily believe that than that she was, right. Because have you seen House of the Dragon? Right. There's a whole entire arc there.
So, so two things are happening in the first kind of decade of their marriage. Since he is off at battle, that means she's alone to basically rule anything he's responsible for ruling. She's very much in charge and in his stead while he's not there. And for, like, what we know, she did. And she took to her responsibilities very seriously. Remember, this is a very educated woman, mm-hmm. and she has the capabilities, and she apparently would, like, she was determined to understand kind of every element that goes into being, like, a count, essentially. And so if someone came to her with a problem, she would call in experts on the problem so she would be educated on that issue to address it properly. And, like, she did not take it as, like, ah, whatever, it's just something I have to do because my husband's not here. Like, this was very much something she wanted to do. And I also say that to bring up the idea that a lot of people have said, well, whenever she was stressed out, that's when she would go kill people. Because she used it as, like, a stress relief whenever her stuff would become, like, really high stress, in that all of this time when he was away and she had to, like, rule his lands, mm-hmm. that's what made her, like, want to kill people. She was stressed out all the time. That's just not true. Yeah. From, like, everything we've seen of her, she was not stressed out. I mean, I'm sure she was stressed in the same way that anyone would be stressed in that situation.
But prepared somewhat.
Yes, but prepared and capable and willing to do that.
Because I mean, you know? As a woman, I feel like she could have, if she didn't want to be doing that, she could have been like, oh, my fragile constitution.
Yeah, and then he could have easily like appointed some other dude to do it.
There's no shortage of power hungry people in this time. Someone would have stepped up, some sort of regent or something.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's what a lot of this is going to be like, and that's why people say this, but I don't think that's true.
That's valid. Because again, we have to debunk history sometimes.
Yeah. So she did this for the 10 years the first 10 years of their marriage, and I think her husband spends most of their marriage apart, but towards, like, kind of after the first decade, he's able to spend a little bit more time at home, because she does eventually go on to have 5 children, 3 of which survive to adulthood. But what's interesting is that her husband, Ferenc, I'm sorry, yeah, her husband. he was known to be a particularly brutal man on the battlefield. And he had a few different kind of tactics that he would employ to kind of take down his enemies that were seen as, even at the time, a little bit ruthless. And it's thought that whenever he would spend time back at the castle, mm-hmm. that he would teach her some of his more ruthless things. So the idea, there's all of these ideas about their relationship, right? The one of them is that they were possibly both gay and they were just in it to be married,
which honestly, the amount of, like, lavender marriages that happened throughout history for the purpose of power and like hierarchy, but like
I'm not saying it couldn't happen,
but
so there's that idea. And then there's basically, and that they didn't really like each other that much, and they were just kind of in it because they are both people of power, and that's what marriages were. There's that concept. And then there's also kind of the total opposite concept, where they were kind of Bonnie and Clyde, and that she found her one true love when it came to, like, murdering. Yes. And that they're, both of them had their own kind of bloodthirsty impulses, and he was able to satisfy his on the battlefield, where she needed to satisfy it in a different way. And so they fed into each other, and they came up with, like, and they taught each other all these, like, ways to torture people. And it's just, it's all, when you look at it, and who knows what the truth of their relationship was, we do not know. Especially because of, like, how the legend evolves, and how her name just gets, like, you know, obviously she's, like, evil, and I'm not saying she's not, but, like, the kind of hysteria that grows around her.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of her stuff is destroyed. And so we don't really have a lot from her, even though, like, with, like, someone living with her wealth and status, we should technically have a lot from her. Like, this is only the 1500s. Like, we could have a lot of stuff.
That's a lot of conjecture for a, for someone who, there's not a lot of primary sources on. Exactly.
And, like, this is another just example of, like, at every point in her life, people try to come up with a reason for why she did what she did. And in reality, who knows why? Maybe she just wanted to. And that's, and maybe there was a reason, quote unquote. But, like, is there ever really a reason for, like, killing dozens of people? No. Yeah, no. So, yeah. Where was I? Oh, yeah. So she's defending their estates. So their marriage from, again, they got married in 1575, and it lasts about 29 years until her husband Ferenc dies on January 4th, 1604, at the age of 48. We don't fully know why he dies. It's said that he had, like, a pain in his leg, and it just, like, maybe it just, like, kept growing and growing until eventually he wasn't able to move, and then he eventually passed away. It's 1604, so, you know, who knows.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, like, the medicine they would have had available, and if they would have just been, like, leech it. And
yeah,
then
they're like, we need to drain your humors. You have too much yellow bile.
And then all of a sudden he did, from, like, exsanguination of blood or something.
Now, what's interesting is that the rumors of what Elizabeth was up to started to kind of grow some strength and grow in their popularity around 1600. So the last kind of few years of their marriage. Now, Ferenc, for what it's worth, was known to, like, when he gave his wife, like, the ability to operate as his, you know, proxy, he fully supported her in every decision that he made. There was some, maybe some idea that maybe it was an abusive relationship, and then
I was gonna ask if there was anything around that, because if he was really violent on the battlefield and then
maybe
came
brought it home, and I'm not saying that's not a possibility, it's definitely a reality for a lot of women throughout history, especially when it seems to kind of, like, these kind of marriages where it's really high status, if they broke up, it would be a whole thing.
Yeah.
That's
also something that we see, like people who, like, are abusive in their marriages seek out power, which is why there's a very high percentage of, like, policemen who are charged with domestic abuse or overlooked for domestic abuse.
Yeah. So, and again, we can't prove any of this. And it's thought maybe, okay, well, maybe she was abused, and that's why she, in turn, you know, took to abusing people in her own way. And I'm not saying that, and again, just like with anything, I'm not saying, we can't prove one way or the other what is happening. But what we do know is that right around the early, early 1600s, we start hearing, like, we have documented proof of people being like, something's up with this lady, something's going on. And one of the first that we actually have record of is a Lutheran minister named István Magyari complains about her publicly and in court in Vienna, saying that girls are going missing and it seems to be connected with her. So kind of publicly accusing, not, I don't know if accusing is too strong of a word, but publicly connecting her with kind of the disappearances of all these women, the
suggestion
right?
is out there now. No putting the lid back on that box.
Yep. So what is happening is essentially women who would go to be servants in her castle, in her home, would kind of never be heard from again. And that happens, of course, kind of slowly at the beginning. And then as they have, as she's kind of killing them off and having to replace them, more and more people kind of catch on to like, huh, my niece went up to that castle a couple months ago.
She hasn't been back for family dinner yet.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And soon they like run out of women.
Oh my God.
Yeah. There's like not enough girls to support her alleged hobby, if you will.
Geez.
Yeah. And that's really what tips people off. And that's what gets people to kind of look at it to begin with. Now, what really does it is she eventually, because she runs out of kind of like peasant women. And now what's interesting too is that at this time in Hungary, at least, the culture of it was that peasants were kind of property, right? Where it's very feudal still. Peasants are at the very bottom, and they were kind of seen as essentially serfs or slaves to work your land. And so the abuse of peasants, while maybe frowned upon, wasn't technically illegal because it's like your property. So there wasn't much that people could do other than be like, hey, I think this lady might be killing all these people.
Yeah.
But like legally there wasn't anything there. That is until, again, she kind of, as the story goes, runs out of peasant women and has to turn to a different source. And this is when she starts her school for women, which she calls a gynasium, which is like a, comes from the ancient Greek word gyna, for women. And it's basically like a finishing school for wealthy aristocratic girls. Now, as the story goes, all of these wealthy families sent their young daughters to the school, and within months they were not heard from again because, you know, she supposedly had killed them. And if you're believing that, now I keep saying, I keep stipulating, because like from what I saw, there's like not any physical evidence that she actually killed anyone. Like there's no, it's all just kind of hearsay. It's all accusations, not saying that those are not legitimate and not saying that's not what happened, but there's no real physical evidence that she killed even a single person.
Well, and if she was somewhat intelligent and educated, which it sounds like she was for the time,
yeah,
she would have, I would have thought that this woman of education would realize, hey, maybe some serfs go missing and people are like, oh no, don't kill your serfs.
Right.
But if she takes the daughters of prominent families,
yeah, people are gonna start to not notice.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it kind of is like, again, part of the legend, part of the story. But supposedly it was this, her turn towards killing more aristocratic girls, that made people finally like kind of key in and pay attention and start demanding that something be done about it. Even still, it took until 1610, around 10 years after the rumors about her really start to gain some traction and people start to notice that something's up, for King Matthias II of Hungary to finally kind of do something about it. He hires a man named Gyorgy Thurzo, who was the Palatine of Hungary, to investigate this. And Thurzo in turn hires two notaries to go around the province and kind of collect firsthand like eyewitness accounts of what she's been doing. Now, they are able to, by the end of 1610, they were able to collect 52 witness statements. But by 1611, that number had grown to over 300 witness statements. There's a lot to be said here, because if you've heard this story, you know that she's accused of killing over 650 women. Now, that number has, like, no bearing in anything that actually happened in the story. We have around 300 witness statements, and even if you take those 300 witness statements and say each of those witness statements correlates to one person killed, that's still...
Jesus.
Not 650 witness statements. Yeah. Like... 300 is still a lot of people to kill.
Yeah.
For sure. But it's not 650.
Yeah.
So.
The math ain't math.
Yeah. Also, 650 is like a very round number.
Yeah. I was going to say, that's a number that someone like procured to sound big.
Yes. Yeah. What's a big number? I know.
It's like how in forensic accounting, like, one of the tells is actually when numbers don't repeat themselves.
Yeah.
Like, if there's a number like 5,467.
Yeah.
The fact that they're like a long enough number should have recurring numbers. And it's actually like something that like, my sister was telling me about that when she was in her forensic accounting class, that like sometimes when it looks too like intentionally, like, it looks like
too random,
you're like, and then that is too random. Yeah. It's generated. Yeah.
Interesting. So yes. So finally, when they kind of get done with their collection of all these witness statements, they get the approval from the king to go in and arrest her. Now, attempts to arrest her had apparently been made before, but this is how the story goes. She was able to kind of clean up and hide her evidence. And
when you're that rich and wealthy.
Yeah. Both because she got some like kind of pre tip off that they're coming for her. Now, it's thought that they were trying to avoid that. So on New Year's Eve of 1612, Mouse is entertaining herself.
Yeah.
New Year's Eve of 1612, they surprise her and caught her red-handed.
During a New Year's party, nonetheless. Uh-huh,
kicking things off right for 1613.
A new year, new me.
Yeah. New year, same old me, actually. Yeah,
that's true.
So, Thurzo, apparently, when he arrested her, he went into town and was like, I caught her red-handed. And from that, we get the story that he had found her naked and covered in blood, the blood of her victims, and, like, all of this stuff. But, like, again, if any of that's true, we have, like, no idea. And then, kind of, like, it doesn't get any more reliable after we move into the trial. Now, this is Elizabeth Bathory. I'm going to talk a little bit about what she actually did to people.
Sorry, I was making sure that Mouse... Yeah. I have to keep track of her toys because she's in and out of the apartment right now.
Yeah.
The door's open. I have to make sure I keep track of which one she leaves in the yard.
Yeah. So, we have confessions from people around her. She was also arrested with four of her ladies-in-waiting, which were accused of being her accomplices and would be the ones who would, like, go and get girls from the villages and bring them back up to the castle. However, the servants that did confess were confessing under torture, which, as we know, is a confession under duress, is
not credible.
Not exactly credible. Now, at the time, they didn't really understand that, so they took it as credible. But from a modern perspective, that's one of those things where you can be like, I'm just going to take that with a grain of salt.
Yeah, it's not credible in a court of law, exactly.
Exactly. So they did confess to assisting her, and they did confess to assisting her not only with the recruitment of women, they also confessed that they were kind of involved in the actual acts themselves.
Also, just to say that even if they were telling the truth, that they weren't coerced into those acts.
Exactly.
By their boss, who could be like, hey, you're next if you don't
have to kill this girl. You're doing this, or guess what? You killed someone and I can have you arrested.
Yeah.
So... What's interesting too is that one of the articles mentioned that the, as I said earlier, a lot of the witness statements were not based on any substantial evidence. And this was a time for, at least in this area of country of Europe, that like almost everything was documented when it came to like some, like a petty crime happening.
Mm.
And like, if someone like stole a loaf of bread or beat someone up, they were going to like issue a letter of complaint. Mm-hmm. And we have those letters from like, cause it's like a court document essentially.
I do love when people are litigious.
Yes. And there's nothing. And so if people really thought that like this lady was killing all these people, don't you think they would have like issued a letter of complaint? Now, yeah. You could flip that on its head. This lady had a lot of money and power and connections.
Mm-hmm.
So even if people felt bold enough to do that, maybe she just kind of talked her buddy over in the law office and was like, hey, you see any letters about me, you get rid of them, you know?
City council payout.
Yeah. So you can take that both ways, but it is just kind of interesting that, again, we have no actual, like, physical evidence that connects her with any of these murders. So, again, the number of 650 supposedly comes from a servant girl that, rumor has it, saw that number in one of her, like, journals, one of Bathory's journals about, like, how many women she killed, but, like... Again, it's like that servant girl that came through this other guy who was saying, well, I know someone who works in the castle, and she saw. And so it's like a very like he said, she said, this whole kind of thing is very he said, she said.
So convoluted.
Yeah. And with that, we get a range in her like murder MO.
Yeah.
Like. Anything and everything. Anything and everything that could be described as, like, torture is what she's thought to have done. This goes from, like, sticking... Okay, this gets a little bit graphic. So, sticking needles in people's lips and under their fingernails. Yeah, I know. That's the rough one.
Sticking that's a visceral.
Yeah, I know. I know.
You say that as I am currently sewing with a needle in my hand. Sorry, I didn't think about it. That's okay. I did stab myself a few minutes ago, and you know what? I'm sure it was not as bad as she was doing, so.
Yes, yeah. Just a little taste.
Said to be doing. Yeah.
Yes, uh-huh. Allegedly. She also, one of her favorite torture methods was also, like, a hot poker, poking all over the body, burning all over the body, particularly because her victims were girls in certain orifices, which, again, connects back to, like, the people like, she was gay because she has problems with women's genitals.
Interesting.
She also was known to bite off chunks of people's flesh. She also was known to douse people in cold water and send them out into the cold to freeze to death. And which, from what I've heard, freezing to death seems like a relatively painless way to die. So for someone who's into torture,
we've talked about the Donner Pass. Yeah. We've talked about Dyatlov.
It's just like going to sleep is what I've heard.
Well, first you get really, really hot.
Yes.
And then you take off all your clothes. And then you fall asleep.
Another thing was... in the summertime, so that was in the wintertime, but in the summertime, she would cover people in honey or jelly and send them out to be eaten by insects, which is just disgusting.
I don't want to know about their insect, how bad their insects would have to be to be eaten alive by just being covered with jelly.
Yeah, there's even some more, like, kind of dramatic stories about how, like, her killing chamber was, like, covered in a layer of water that, or not water, blood that was like 2 inches thick, and you could like scoop it up by the handful. And there were so many bodies around the castle that were never disposed of, that dogs just carried people's arms and legs around in their mouths. Like, there's all of these stories, and sure, they might be true, but they also probably aren't. Like, you know, like
at that point, it sounds so like. Because, I mean, they may not have had, like, modern hygiene.
Yeah.
But at some point, the smell would become the insects. The decay would become so bad that you can't leave bodies laying around a castle like that. Yeah. And you know what that tells us? That at some level, this is a disproportionate boogeyman.
Yes.
Maybe something that young ladies were told to stay in their rooms at night. Like, don't leave after dark. You. She's going to get you. Like, don't go working in strange homes. Yeah. Or maybe even they were afraid of the aristocracy, so people didn't want their daughters working for them. Like,
yeah. So it's really interesting. And I have a whole section here where I talk about, like, the legend of it. Because a lot of, I think, it's hard to kind of, like, when you have something that grows to this legendary status, it's really hard to see through the, like, fog that that creates to the reality of what happened.
Yes.
Which is why a lot of historians that have looked at this in a more critical light lately have been like, y'all, there's no evidence that she did this to anyone. Not saying that she didn't, and I think it's actually pretty much agreed that she definitely did kill people.
Yeah.
It's definitely something that she did, but just, like, anything outside of that, anything that is, like, the fantasy element of it, like, that's probably not real.
Yeah, like, historically back something.
Yeah. So, yeah. Because of her status as a countess and a very wealthy person in society and everything, it was ultimately decided that a public trial would have been just, like, way too much of a scandal and just, like, it would have been a mess. So instead, she was simply put in house arrest and was forced to live out the rest of her days in her castle. Now,
how terrible.
I know.
I must live in a castle for my crimes.
Fortunately for everyone, because she could have very easily continued killing, she passed away around 2 years after her arrest on August 21st, 1614, at the age of only 54. She died in her sleep. And it's not known what she died of. It's her last words to anyone were her telling her bodyguard that her hands felt cold, and then him saying, "Oh, that's fine," and then just go to bed. Which, like, it's 1614. So what else are you supposed to say?
Was he going to say, "You're as cold as ice"?
Right. Like, yeah. Like, yeah, it's from all the people you killed.
Yeah. We're not to that point yet.
You. Yeah.
Like, would you like a leech, ma'am?
Right. I know. I'll put one on your finger. She was initially buried in, like, the town cemetery. However, the village was very upset at that, and so her body was moved to her birth home, where it was buried in the family crypt, the Bathory family crypt. However, today we do not know exactly where her body is.
Oh.
So, dun, 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 adding to that mystery.
I was going to say that not knowing where a body is adds to so much, like, lore.
Mm-hmm. Now, historians looking back at this case have thought that, again, the question is, why did this story become what it became?
Mm-hmm.
Now, contextually, when we're looking at England, we are, like, middle of kind of the really kind of upturn of witch hunts and witch trials.
I almost said something earlier, yeah.
So, while she's never accused of being a witch, it does kind of seem like the same sort of hysteria.
Yeah.
If these are all, like, you know, if this in its time became as, like, over exaggerated as it is now,
which is, I mean, if you want to learn more about that hysteria, go listen to the episodes, because we do some deep dives on it. But there's, like, religious aspects, social aspects to wanting women to be evil.
Mm-hmm. Now, your point earlier about people maybe just not liking the aristocracy is actually believed to be kind of one of the main reasons why this happened and why she was kind of targeted in this way and created to be this, like, evil noblewoman. Because it's thought that, like, a lot of the accusations were very politically motivated. She was a very wealthy and very powerful woman. And after her husband died, that was hers. And so she was this woman who maybe wasn't so well liked and maybe had some interesting things happening around her. And all of a sudden you start getting these rumors that she's killing hundreds of women, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like, is it the people kind of handling or having a hard time handling a powerful woman?
Yeah. Trying to discredit
in their
her,
own right. Yeah. It's also, she was a Calvinist, and so maybe it was, like, the Lutheran church targeting her.
Yeah,
because, again, that Lutheran pastor, not pastor, but Lutheran
pastor,
was the one who, like, kind of raised a red flag about her for, like, initially. So, so there's all of these reasons why. And also, a couple centuries later, we get the creation of the story of Dracula, which is set in about the same area, and it has this, you know, connection to someone living in a big castle who's killing all of these people, and blood is very involved.
Reclusive and secretive and single, yes, maybe. Yeah.
So it's thought to be that Bathory herself was a big inspiration for the story of Dracula. There are a lot of, like, just parts of the story that I didn't include, and I said put in, like, the legend part of it, because it was just, like, too much to also include them in, like, the actual biography.
Yeah.
But, one of the ways that her seizures were thought to have been treated, and again, this also goes into kind of the creation of the idea of vampires, because, like, seizures in general were kind of treated like this, not just hers, but one of the kind of, as the story goes, is that one of the treatments for her seizures was that they would rub the blood of someone who didn't suffer them onto her lips, using a piece of their skull. And it's thought that maybe that was the start of her bloodlust. Yeah, I don't know.
I'll never understand.
Yeah, I don't know. It's also thought that her family, before she went, because when she was 11, when she became betrothed to her husband, she moved in with them, and they had, from what it seems like, a very idyllic life too, so she was not being abused in that situation either. But it's thought that maybe her original family that she lived in before her her parents died, that other people outside of her parents were, like, involved in some things that they should not have been involved in, and that she was exposed by aunts and uncles to satanic worship or witchcraft. But there's literally no evidence to support any of that. And even, like, how she was caught, remember, Thurzo goes into the village, he's like, I caught her red-handed. Most people actually think that she was just probably having dinner when he walked in, and it was like, aha, I've caught you in your chambers.
I honestly, it sounds to me like the plot of a witch hunt movie.
Yes.
Like you said, like, and now I'm thinking of it in that context of, like, women levitating, killing animals for familiars, like, all of this is that, like, demonization of, like, strong women, or, like, women functioning outside the confines of society.
Yeah, and it's true. It's true. Now, again, if you've heard anything about this story, you've heard the idea that she was killing all of these women's virgins, women and virgins specifically, to bathe in their blood to help restore her youth.
That's how I do it.
That's how you do it?
Yeah. Don't check the floorboards. No Botox, just just the blood of virgins.
Just the blood of virgins. If you listen to some conspiracy theorists, that's still what people are doing in Hollywood.
Oh, God.
Adrenochrome, anyone?
What?
You've never heard of adrenochrome?
No.
Oh, we'll have to talk about that later.
Okay.
Oh my God, I can't believe it. Okay.
No.
Okay.
I get really annoyed with conspiracy theories
sometimes. I do too.
So it's like I either, like, go on, like, a 3-week kick where I Google every single conspiracy theory there is, or I don't look at any conspiracy theories for like 5 years.
I know. I'm definitely in the second option right now. But yeah, so because, you know, she wouldn't just be killing these people without any other for any reason other than just to kill them, she had to have a reason. And it's thought that she needed to keep her youth, and so she was bathing in the blood of virgins to retain her, like, youthful beauty. Now, this, like, part of the story does not actually appear anywhere at any point until over 100 years after she dies.
Wow.
The first time we have it written down is in a book written called the Tragica Historia, which is the first written account of the Bathory case in general by a Jesuit scholar named Laszlo Taroxi in 1729.
I don't know about you, but that sounds entirely credible to me.
Oh, really?
Historia Tragica? Oh,
yeah. 115 years after she died. Now, this was taken as kind of fact as part of the case. Like, for a long time, people mm-hmm. were just like, oh, well, this is the earliest account, so it must be what happened. What's interesting is that we actually uncovered the witness accounts in 1765, but they weren't really questioned until 1817, when those accounts were published for the first time, and people got to see the actual witness statements. Again, those like 300 statements they collected about this case for themselves, and none of them mentioned this idea of virgin blood or bathing in it for her beauty. Like, none of them, even in like the most ridiculous things that they did accuse her of, that comes from nowhere. So it's thought to that just be purely just as the story evolved over hundreds of years. And by the time that this scholar came to write it down, that was kind of part of the legend of Elizabeth Bathory and not necessarily the actual what happened. So I already talked about Dracula. She also was, she has been given the Guinness World Record for the most prolific female murderer, even though that 650 number is just kind of essentially arbitrary.
Right.
Most historians think that if she did actually kill people, the number was probably like 60 to 80 women, which is still a lot of people.
Yeah, I was about to say, it's
still a lot of people. Incredible. Yes, yeah. But nowhere near the hundreds that the story has kind of turned into. And then she actually would be later written as the the villain in a Dracula sequel written by Bram Stoker's great-grandnephew. She's referenced in DC comics, American Horror Story. Like, metal songs are written about her. Like, she's, again, thought to be one of... So, like, from what I understand, Bloody Mary is just an urban legend. It doesn't really come from anywhere. But right. if you look through history and try to attribute to anyone, it's yes. thought to be that she's, like, one of the people you can attribute that legend from coming to. So even in something like Bloody Mary, she's kind of in the popular culture that way. Like, she still has, like, this lasting impact on history.
I was gonna say, at this point, you can't get rid of her from history yes. if you try. Yeah.
And it's interesting because, like, I don't know, I feel like and it might just be that, like, legend of it, you know, like, you don't really know much about her because what she supposedly did
mm-hmm.
overtook so much of that.
Right.
And so it's hard to, again, look through that fog, look through the veil that the legend creates around her and see what the truth was. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that is wow. Elizabeth Bathory, one of the first female serial killers.
Wow, that was good, because honestly, like, it's almost harder to debunk
mm-hmm.
a history than to explain one, because yeah. you're working against, hey, like, there's a lot of hearsay, especially when you go that far back in history yeah. where there's a serious lack of primary documentation. Mm-hmm. Like, there is, like, all you can say is that we don't know.
Yeah,
not this did or didn't, but just like,
yeah,
hey, and we got no clue.
And that's why I say, like, you know, I'm not saying she didn't kill a bunch of people, but I'm also not saying she did.
Right.
And that's just because we don't know. And what are the motivations around the people who have always been saying that mm-hmm. she killed all these people, you know?
And one of our unintentional topics for today, because we could have chosen serial killers, like, and done a true crime, like, so-and-so yeah. this day on this day died. Mm-hmm. But, like, we are, A, not a serial killer crime podcast.
No.
The point that we try to make when we're talking about stuff like that is the historic importance of it. And I think she's a really great example of, like, how history treats, like, sensational stories and how they grow. And how mm-hmm. we actually have to be really careful about how we discuss and publicize and talk about things. Because, yeah. like, you run the risk of making your tale more widely mm-hmm. known than the actual facts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, no one in the 1600s was like, ah, we shouldn't say this in a couple right. hundred years, there are going to be two girls doing a podcast, and right. they, you know, but the importance of some of a, like, a murderer or a big event like this isn't always the numbers or stats or whether or not it happened. It's more to help us understand the context of what's going on around us at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So you did a really, really good job with that.
Thank you. And it's, yeah. Yeah, it's always interesting, again, doing one that's, like, more legend than anything.
Yeah.
Because, again, it's like, what does it tell us that this
mm-hmm.
that this legend has lasted so long, mm-hmm. you know, that we still know the name Elizabeth Bathory.
Yeah. And from our historic skill, how can we place it? How good are we at placing it, understanding the context of it? And,
right. Yeah.
And we say that all the time on this podcast. It's not really about dates and times. A historian's job is to understand it.
Mm-hmm. Understand how it fits into the story of history and how it changes the story of history.
Yeah.
And why, what's the significance of it being there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And one of the most important things you can do as a historian is like debunk your own misconceptions, because mm-hmm. historians cannot know every second of every history. Like, that's not what you get your degree for.
Yeah.
It's not to memorize dates and tell you, this day is the time in 1776 at the courthouse. And then, like, that's not the point.
Yeah.
It's to understand it cohesively and mm-hmm. its impact on society now. Yeah. So that's also what we're going to have to do in my topic. Yeah. And you kind of like got to eat crow sometimes and be like, yeah, you know what? As a historian, like as someone with a history degree, I still believe this because this is the narrative I was told either
by
high school history teacher who didn't understand mm-hmm. it, or like the internet over time or something, which is a huge contributor to myths and legends. But like, you got to, as a historian, be able to say like, yeah, no,
we were wrong.
We were wrong.
And even if, you know, outside of history teachers or internet or anything, like that's always been part of history mm-hmm. is like the legend of it was. And then when people actually were like, wait a minute,
it's like,
wait, where were we getting that from?
Mm-hmm. Whoopsie.
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. So great job. Do you want to do recommendations real fast? And then we'll jump into my own unintentional debunking. Like I don't think either of us intended to debunk myths today, but we both did. So that's accidentally a part of our topic, our theme.
Yeah. I have one.
Okay.
I just lost it though. Okay. I have only watched the first 15 minutes of this show, but there's a new show out on Hulu called Shogun.
It's on. Okay, I added it to my list and then Hulu logged me out.
No.
And I was like, I don't have the password, but I'm going to text my dad for it today.
So, I started watching it last night and then I was sleepy, so I turned it off because I wanted to actually pay attention.
I've heard it is a focused TV show. It's not a background thing.
Yes. Yeah. One of the reasons why I want to recommend it is, even though I haven't seen much of it, I saw a TikTok about just the care that they put into making accurate translations.
Oh.
Because the show, if you can't get from the title, is about mm-hmm. Japan, Shogunate Japan. And so a lot of, especially the first episode, is in Japanese because the show is based in Japan and the people are speaking Japanese.
That's really great.
Yeah.
I'm glad that like historic shows are actually doing that.
Right. And not just like people with a British accent.
Yes.
Yeah. That's what a period piece is.
It's a British accent.
Yeah.
And some Regency costumes, even if it's not the right period.
Yes. Yeah. Empire waist dresses. That's historic.
just make the hair pulled back.
Yes.
That means it's historic, right?
That means it's historic. Yes. Mm-hmm. A corset. That's historic.
A corset. Yeah, just one kind of corset through all of history.
Yeah, that's the only one they wore. It's a corset. Why would they?
I mean, have you not seen Rain?
That's very accurate, yes. Yeah. So apparently when they were creating the script, the script writers are all like English speakers, native English speakers, but they wrote what they wanted to have, you know, the Japanese script say in Japanese. They sent it to some translators, and then they went through an extra layer of, they got the translation back for the Japanese, and they went to a Japanese playwright and a screenwriter to basically get the best captions for the show.
Wow.
So when you're watching the show, the captions are not like the auto-generated captions in English that you get a lot of the time. It's actually in the show. Like, it has like its own font. Like, it's part of the show, the English captions for the Japanese speaking. And someone, the guy I was listening to on TikTok talk about this, was like, if they put that much care into just their captioning, like, I can't imagine like the rest of the show and what it's going to be like. So that seems pretty promising to me.
Yeah.
So if you're into like, you know, Japan and Japanese history and all of that kind of stuff, it seems like a really good
I'm definitely gonna
as
soon as I get my password back, I will definitely be watching it. And interestingly enough, what I was gonna recommend also has a little bit about closed captioning. I, in the midst of Netflix and their, it's ironic I say this, as my Hulu logged me out, even though I am, like, it is, and it's like our family's account. With all of the streaming services instituting these new, like, policies and sharing restrictions and stuff like that, and going from, like, oh, only three people at a time versus, like, you have to be physically in the household, which does not serve, for instance, children of divorced parents or who are in multiple household situations.
Or God forbid, if you want to, like, watch it at work in the background and watch it at your house. Like,
there's so... All of those inconsiderations aside, I know a lot of people have been discussing, like, hey, how do you, like, A, make conscious decisions and also save money, but also, like, make your discontent with that known? And a lot of people were like, hey, whittle down which services you're using, maybe use, like, one per month at a time, et cetera, et cetera. But I will endorse Dropout.
Yes, I have heard Dropout.
I have a Dropout subscription. It's previously known as College Humor. So if you were on Facebook, like, 5 to 10 years ago, and you remember all those, like, College Humor videos, that group is amazing. And I heard one guy talking about it. He's like, there is no ethical consumption to capitalism. Dropout is as close as it gets. I think I watched the same
exact TikTok.
It is.
He was like, I'm not a fan of anything, but I am a fan of College Humor. Of Dropout.
Because
they do all the D20 stuff.
Yes. Yeah. They're Dimension 20, which is a D&D thing. I'm a huge fan of Brennan Lee Mulligan, who runs a lot of their stuff, but Abria is one of their other DMs who runs it. She's amazing. Their casts are really diverse, both with racial representation and queer representation. Their stuff's also just really funny. I was listening to a couple content watching a couple content creators who are hard of hearing and deaf, and they were like, yeah, actually the captions on this are incredible because it's not like auto-generated. They, like, you get more out of the show if you have captions on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the way they're just incredibly inclusive. Also during the SAG after strike, like, Brendan Lee Mulligan was very heavily involved in that. They're all very socially and ethically conscientious. And they're doing, like, fundraisers and stuff. They split any, like, extra profit they make as a company, like, among the actual employees and cast, and the Palestinian Children's Relief Fund, they're doing a huge, like, benefit for them this week. They are all openly speaking out against the genocide going on in Palestine. So I've always liked Dropout, mostly because, and I'll admit, like, it is a little bit more of a niche content. They don't just have shows streaming on there. It's their content. But I really enjoy Dropout, and I really appreciate the way it's run and the way that the people on it represent themselves. So I do endorse Dropout. And they've got some really funny, like, game shows and stuff on there that I love watching.
Actually, one, they were with College Humor for a long time, and then I think they went independent just, like, a couple years ago. But Drawfee on YouTube is a lot of fun, and they started from College Humor Dropout, and they are just, like, some very, very, very talented artists.
Yeah.
And they just, like, get random prompts, and they talk to each other while they draw, and it's great to have it on the background, because, frankly, they're hilarious, and it's just, like, really cool to watch. And so I have also, like, I enjoy their content, even though I don't watch as much of it as you do, probably. So I can, but I can also vouch for, like, a more casual viewing experience.
It's just rare to find I think part of it is that they are still small, so they can still pay attention to those details and really focus on it. But as they've grown, they have not compromised on their ethics and morals and representation, which I really, really appreciate, especially when it comes to things like game shows and D&D, where, like, it's really easy to get lost in that. But they do a fantastic job. And also, I just kind of have a crush on Brennan Lee Mulligan. But I think everyone who watches any of his D&D campaigns does, because, man, he does some insane stuff. If you don't like D&D, you can give it a chance by watching Crown of Candy. It's their Candyland Game of Thrones kind of mashup crossover campaign. It'll send you for a mind twist, man. And it all, like, all the sub-commentaries on, like, capitalism and, like, the perils of war and everything. And it's all very, like, politically motivated. And you're just watching the whole time, like, yeah, okay. So, yeah, I recommend Dropout. Cool. It's a good service that I do. It's a good streaming service I do actually feel consciously proud of. But, yeah. So...
Let's get into it.
I guess we just talk about another murderer today.
Yeah.
I'm going to go through part one of my notes. Halfway through, I think it'll get me through the supposed crimes. And then next week, I'll start off probably with the capture and kind of debunking a little bit of serial killer known as H.H. Holmes. Okay. And like I said, I do love debunking stories every once in a while. And I am very willing to admit I had a lot of this history wrong. I think it's very easy to get this person incorrect because even across the stuff I was looking at, a lot of the time the words being used to describe him were very inconsistent with the actions he was actually performing. For instance, the idea that H.H. Holmes is arguably not a serial killer, other than like the raw definition. You know, does a serial killer constitute murdering more than one people in a spree? Does it have to do with intent, et cetera, et cetera? But if you look at it very closely, H.H. Holmes was not necessarily killing people to kill people. His main motivation behind it was actually a con man. It wasn't really a compulsion, it seems, but merely that these murders were a means to an end, and that he may not have actually killed enough people, we can't be sure of it, to be considered a serial killer. We also, because he was a con man who lied for a living, cannot take almost any accounts as truth. We cannot take his own confessions or non-confessions as truth. So the summary of H.H. Holmes is that he is perceived to be America's first serial killer. And I say perceived heavily. In a way that he was the first modern of his time. America has known plenty of people to kill a lot of people at this point. But he was a very prolific swindler and con man. He's as much lore as he is history. And some of the facts have gotten very mixed up or conflated or fabricated. And I will note, just going into this, that that as far as like number of victims, he is confirmed and convicted of killing. There is one. We have one person that he was actually convicted of murdering.
Wow.
So that's a far cry from like the perception everyone has that he was like famously murdering hundreds of people, and that he was, you know, so far entrenched in it that everyone knew what he was doing, you know? We're going to start at the beginning of his life, and I'm not going to do one mass debunking at the end because so much of his life is hearsay. So along the way, I will be giving some, like, you did.
I know. It was kind of like, it's like I had to do that, and then there's so much about her that I had to do a big dump at the end.
I'll be doing like a little bit of that too. Like, you sprinkle it throughout, and at the end you're like, by the way, take none of this seriously.
Here's also all the stuff that I couldn't fit in.
And in some cases I'll say, oh, it was this, or maybe none of them. Who knows? We're going to start at the beginning though, which is going to take us to circa, again, we are not exactly sure, May 16th of 1861. In New Hampshire, specifically Gilmanton, I believe it's pronounced. We believe that H.H. Holmes had a pretty standard childhood, that he was the middle child and his parents were a Methodist couple with decent money, enough to afford him a decent education. There are accounts that dispute the quality of his upbringing. A couple claims that he might have faced abuse in his younger years from a very religiously tormented father, which may also be legend that comes from the misconception that all serial killers, again, have to have some really difficult formative events in their early years that force them to be as cruel as they are, which is often taken because people can't comprehend how people can just be cruel. But a lot of accounts just deem Holmes as a pretty standard child, not particularly I should just say nature versus nurture, that we might not have had some bad nurturing that coincided. It might have just been, for once, just some bad nurture or nature. So his birth name is Herman Webster Mudgett.
Nice.
Which is quite the name.
That is quite the name, isn't it?
Isn't it also the name that they use in Annie?
That sounds really familiar.
Isn't it the Mudgets? No, the Mudges.
It's something like that.
Yeah, claims to be Ralph and Ann Mudges. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think, is it just Mudge?
Mudge, something maybe. Like that. Yeah, Mudge. But I heard it at first and I was like, I wonder if that was an ode to this at all, because he's a con man.
Yeah.
But his birth name was Herman Webster Mudgett. You'll know him as H.H. Holmes, obviously, which mm-hmm. is a moniker of Dr. Henry Howard Holmes. Later, this man would be referred to as the Beast of Chicago in some places, but those are mostly given to him by the press. Mm-hmm. The family that he was born into, though, had money, and they were affluent enough or secure enough financially to provide him a decent education. Mm-hmm. He showed a pretty impressive intelligence at a young age, which has also been a conversation among serial killers about, serial killers are brilliant and they outsmart the police all the time, et cetera, et cetera. But there's been some studies recently that show the majority of serial killers don't actually tend to have high IQs.
Yeah.
It's just that the ones that evade capture or get away with it for longest.
Yeah.
And become famous, therefore,
right.
have higher IQs.
Yeah, so it kind of skews the public perception.
Exactly. Yeah. But he did seem to display some intelligence in a younger age. This intelligence showed itself in some very stereotypically serial killer-ish ways. Mm-hmm. He had a propensity for dissecting animals.
Mm, yeah, never a good sign.
And they talk about, like, I think it's actually a debunked theory among criminal profiling stuff, but, like, the triad, the pyramid of, fires, homicidal bedwetting. Yeah, that's what it is. Like, fires, bedwetting, and, like, animal cruelty or something like that. But whether or not he was cruel to them, I don't know. But he did seem to have a inclination to experiment medically on small animals, or at least their corpses.
I mean, whether or not your kid ends up being a serial killer, that's not a good thing for a kid to be doing.
No.
That's like, child therapist.
Please, help. If anything, your kid is risking rabies. So, like, maybe don't do that. But in this day and age, I mean, think about the time period, we're not quite to, therapy is a beneficial way to treat children yet.
Right.
We see him sort of channel that into an interest in medicine and surgery.
Mm, yeah.
I've always kind of wondered how many people, like...
Yeah, have some inclinations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there are, like, reports of, doctors who, performing without anesthesia or something like that, who just tend to show some proclivities that, like, aren't what normal standards call for.
Yeah.
But this leading into his medicine career, he finishes high school at Philip Exeter Academy when he's 16. And this is when he changes his name to Henry Howard Holmes. It may have been a tribute to the detective Sherlock Holmes. But he pops around from school to school a little bit. He takes a brief stint at the University of Vermont, but dislikes it, and he leaves within the year, I believe, and he ends up at the University of Michigan at the med school there. It's not completely clear, the exact date, but before he leaves medical school, medical school, he marries his first wife at age 17. Her name is Clara Lovering. We know it's somewhere around 1878.
Okay.
Throughout his time at University of Michigan, he's not the most dedicated student. He's kind of just subpar. And it's interesting that people talk about his high IQ at a young age. Maybe he was one of those kids that burned out a little bit later, or maybe he was in college and not focusing. Maybe he was more worried about his little side hustle in college than actually studying.
Mm-hmm.
Because he liked to take cadavers, and the reports on whether or not he purposefully disfigured or mutilated them, whether or not that was something he enjoyed doing or did it for the con, is two different things. But he was very focused on his little side hustle, where he would take cadavers or people going on their way to their graves and then staging them as if they had been in some sort of accident or death. For some of them, he would actually try to register them with life insurance policies before he would place the bodies somewhere so that he could collect the money on it. So he's, like, genuinely side hustling with cadavers here.
Interesting.
And I will also note that this is a time in history when things like operating theaters and learning from cadavers are starting to become a thing.
Yeah.
That we start to see like actual practices and research being done in colleges in this way. So this is not like, oh my God,
just
random bodies.
But just look up like the history of grave robbing.
And yeah.
You'll learn a lot.
Kick off around this time period.
Yeah.
Which is also why a lot of like I had some stuff show up in a museum one time, some pictures of a Victorian studying group with a cadaver, and I was like talking to someone about it, and she was like, no, you can't ever use that because that cadaver,
like, most likely
we don't know where it came from.
Yeah.
And then she was like, in that photo, just it's ethically, you just don't want to do that. And I was like, oh, very good point.
Good to know.
Yeah. So it's not that it wouldn't be considered odd, though, to be doing this with cadavers, because while they're being used now in medicine to understand it, if you think like 100 years before, the idea of cutting into a body after it died was not a thing. Like, autopsies were not really a standardized thing that you did to someone every time they died so you could ensure how they died. Like, this would have been still pretty kind of like, ooh, what is this guy doing?
Yeah.
So either way, he was playing a risky game with this whole life insurance con thing. He may have actually been working partially with a professor, because whether or not he was just getting life insurance policies on them or he was finding cadavers and then selling them back to the school is kind of messy and mixed up. But either way, his criminal leanings were obviously apparent at this point in his life, and stealing from graves and medical wards is not a good look for anyone. There's a slight kink in some graduation plans, I believe, around 1884. He does get that medical degree within 2 years, but there was a hiccup there. I believe a woman stepped forward and was like, hey, he promised to marry me, and then he didn't, which in this time is actually like marriages are a little bit more legally policed than they are now, or at least in a different way. I only saw one account of that, but one of the things that H.H. Holmes is charged with, or well, not charged with, but is guilty of, is bigamy. Like, he did marry multiple women illegally. So you kind of have to be like, yeah, I'm sure he did promise to marry someone, because that's part of his con. That's part of his ruse.
Yeah.
Now, we're looking at the year 1884. And I cannot remember. The episode last week is your one about the Eiffel Tower, right? It would have dropped last week.
Yes.
Okay, making sure we didn't record out of order.
Yeah.
Then we've already talked a little bit last week about how a lot of women who are taken advantage of in cons don't want to admit it because it's embarrassing and it's also makes you look like you were taken advantage of, or that you're flighty, or, you know, all these bad stereotypes about women that women didn't necessarily want to fess up to. So if he did... Well, he did make this part of his con, but by taking advantage of women more readily, he had a more open opportunity. But regardless of what he was convincing early on for women to do, et cetera, he does pass his medical exams in 1884. And within the next year, he moves to Chicago. But note, he is married at this time to Clara Lovering. And by heading to Chicago, there's two accounts here. One, that he abandons his wife and son to start over in Chicago, but some accounts claiming that Clara was actually the one to leave him in 1884, going back to live with her parents and taking her son with her because there was some semblance of abuse in the household. They never got back to together or anything like that, but the important part of that speculation is that they did not get divorced, which means he is still legally married, and it is illegal for him to marry anyone else.
Bigamy.
So whether or not, whatever your take is on their relationship, he was not allowed to be marrying anyone else or courting them or frauding himself and claiming that he wasn't married. So this little jump to Chicago is in the medical field of things. He utilizes that degree, and by 1886, he's in Chicago and he takes the job of a pharmacist. This is when we start using him or start seeing him use the actual name Dr. Henry H. Holmes. And we will see a million different aliases, some of which were taken from his victims. or people believed to be his victims. It's almost annoying, the lack of primary documentation on this, and that any primary documentation we could have had, like newspapers, is almost moot, and we'll get to that later, but it sucks. Because it would be really interesting to see a list of, say, his aliases. If there was, like, a government database, it would be really cool to read through it all, but that doesn't exist at this time, so. The story next of how he procures his own pharmacy is also disputed. One account says that the pharmacist he was working for passes away, slash, may have been murdered and left his business to his widow, but the widow is sort of victimized by Holmes, or at least Holmes convinced her to sell the store to him, and then may have murdered her in return, but that the widow supposedly is said to have moved to California after she sold it to him, but then it's just like never verified, and it's possible that he killed her because they like didn't have a good track on her after that. But then again, this is not the FBI database where you're gonna type in a name and get like someone's entire life story. They can't just be like, hey, has anyone heard of this woman before? And all across the US, everyone's like, no, sorry, man. Like, doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
But most accounts tell us that the owner of the drugstore never necessarily died. That the owner's name was Elizabeth Holton, and she actually gave Holmes a job. And he worked hard enough for her that he saved up enough money to actually buy it from her legally by right. But somewhere during this span, he's married to another woman named Murda Belknap. So he's got two wives, only one of which is he allowed to have. And now we get to talk about con man versus serial killer. The murders that we start to see, or suspect now at least, are very utilitarian. There are claims that he may have killed a childhood friend, or that he also murdered someone in his college years, or that he killed the first business owner. Like, all of these things are, the first two, if they were true, that he killed a childhood friend or a college friend, those would most likely be victims of opportunity because he wanted to kill them. Not so much, I have to kill this person for their life insurance policy. But the first ones that we can really point a finger at and say, this person may have been a victim. Like, this is a name. This is their last seen date. Could have been his. Are after he makes it to Chicago. The con man, and they're almost all attributed to him because he benefited from their deaths financially or strategically. And that's kind of the way that if we're going to track realistic murders of his, they're going to be somewhere in the double digits, probably lower double digits. And we've got to take him still with a grain of salt. So after procuring the pharmacy for himself, he buys land across the street from it, which at the time was an empty lot. And he starts to design what would become his media claim to fame. Okay, I'll hold that one off for a second.
You know what? This is also another theme.
Castles.
Murder castles.
That's the title of the episode, everybody. Yep. Just murder castles.
Yep.
Oh, that's actually a really fun episode name. I like that. Yeah. So his position at the pharmacy also gave him proximity to his employees, which he required employees and the families of his employees, to some extent, to have life insurance policies. Which is kind of surprising because, like, that's not, as far as I know in Victorian times, I don't know a great deal about the legal side of life insurance policies.
Yeah.
But I don't think they were as common as they are now.
I would wager to say
especially among the working class, maybe among like medical pharmacists and doctors who could afford them, but for the majority of people like stenographers and stuff, that would not have been a terribly common thing. So this stood also for like the not just his employees, but people he might have had influence over, i.e. like if he was dating someone or had maybe like a hotel employee or two, like the lower ranked ones.
Like lower.
There's no good way to say that. Like the more grunt work that was being done, maybe he didn't care so much on them, but the majority of them, he either convinced them to take those policies out on his own or was kind of helpful, maybe even going so far as to pay the premium on the policy if he was listed as the beneficiary.
Yeah, that's suspicious.
I'm wondering why more people weren't like, oh, what the hell.
I guess I'm not making like my one boss. Of the first times anyone's ever done the life insurance scam.
And he might have been able to swing it as like, hey, the person who gets screwed if you die is me, because I'm hiring you to do this work, and if you can't do the work or something happens...
Because you're dead.
I run out of money. He might have been able to kind of portray it in that way. So... just imagining that conversation with some poor like counter person who's like trying to just learn pharmacy and he's like, hey, by the way, you got a life insurance policy? Because if someone asked me that, I'd be like, excuse me. But
could you imagine going to your job at like McDonald's and they're like, your part-time job in high school, and they're like, you have a life insurance policy?
They're like holding your head over a vat of frying oil and they're like, hey, but you wish you had that life insurance policy. Now, some of his earliest victims that we have like names for and probable belief that he killed come from this span of his time in the pharmacy. The earliest of which credibly would have been Julius Smithy and her daughter Pearl Connor. He had a pharmacist in his employment, and the wife was Julia. So Holmes was almost definitely having an affair with Julia. Con man as he is, he and her are having some sort of relationship. The pharmacist in Holmes' employment finds out and leaves. It seems that Julia and Pearl stay either in the care or in the employment of H.H. Holmes. Holmes later makes multiple confessions to this of different sorts. They go missing on about Christmas time of 1891, the mother and daughter. Holmes claimed later that the mom and daughter were visiting like a sister, a sick sister, or that they had fled her husband's abusive situation or whatever, et cetera, et cetera. Later, Holmes admits to having attempted to perform an abortion, which Holmes would not have been medically qualified to do. And also the mortality rate on abortions in this time period is not good.
Yeah.
So he goes around from like, oh, she's not here. Oh, she's not here, to like, oh, well, she didn't die natural. It wasn't my fault. It was a like complication from a procedure. And that's much later. This is not something he confesses to soon. It does not also account for the missing daughter. A botched abortion on the mom could have led to that, but the daughter Pearl is missing too.
Yeah.
There is some kind of speculative evidence that there's a local man who was paid to essentially skin a body so that it could be sent as a cadaver to a lab, and that it was a woman of unusual height. Julia was almost 6 foot. Which would have been
interesting.
A little more uncommon in this time.
Yeah.
So again, he was never charged with that murder.
Yeah.
We don't have forensic evidence.
Right.
Yet, / maybe we do later. We'll get to that later. But that's suspected to be one of his first kills, is Julia and her daughter. Other early victims may have included Minnie and Nanny Williams around the time of the Chicago World Fair, or Emmeline, I believe it's pronounced Seagrand. But he's targeting women, A, because it's, you know, like, it's terrible, but, like, single women at this time don't have as many means and are going to be more reliant on him by necessity and
much, much more vulnerable.
Yeah, vulnerable is a great way to describe it. Sorry, I got Mouse an enrichment toy and now she thinks there's always treats in it, not just when I put them in there. Okay, I'm taking this away from you. So I took away Mouse's toy. We had to plug in the laptop, which means that Cal had to unplug her mic.
Hello,
so, yeah, she's over there. If she has anything to say, she can relay it to me, or if y'all can hear it,
yes,
might not need to.
Might be distant, but I'm here.
Yes. So, anyways, yes. So, he was conning women, again, vulnerability, ease of access, especially single women. We'll get into that later, but that's who makes up the majority of his target demographic, not necessarily for murder, but for targeting them for cons that he then carried out by murdering them.
Yeah.
So like, if you,
so it's like oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, it's like a conning someone out of their life insurance is inevitably going to require their murder. So like, it's just kind of like. Yeah, it's like his unfortunate little footnote. Anyways, during all that time at the pharmacy and the earlier victims, like, well, Pearl and Julia would have been through the pharmacy. Minnie and Nanny Williams are expected to have been brought into his web of lies around the time of the Chicago World Fair. Let's jump ahead to that. Actually, let's jump back a little before, because the murder castle is completed by the time the Chicago World's Fair exists. This, I'm going to set the scene.
Yeah.
Spires rise above the street. Haunted ghosts stare out the windows as you hear shrieks. Shrieks from indoors.
Those, like, really poorly made documentaries. It's just like basically like a slideshow.
You kind of
like,
are.
2003.
Yeah. Because that's not the case at all. If you actually look up H.H. Holmes' Murder Castle, it does not look like a castle. It does not look like any murders have taken place there. And we don't actually know if any murders did take place there. We'll get more into that later about why there's all these misconceptions. But he does buy a plot of land across from the pharmacy. He does build a large building on it that, by our standards of building codes and impressiveness of structure, could be considered a castle. If I lived in there, I would consider it a castle because it's got more than, like, two rooms.
It's like an Ella Enchanted when the stepmom gets there and she's like, I thought you said you lived in a castle. And he said, I said a man's house is his castle.
I forgot about that line. Oh my gosh, I gotta go watch Ella Enchanted now. I'm assuming they could hear that. They could probably hear that, right?
It's an Ella Enchanted reference.
Yeah, it was an Ella Enchanted reference. But it's a he built what is eventually a three-story structure. It's something akin to a hotel in a way. The people surrounding it call it a castle, and the term murder just kind of gets added later by newspapers. Mm-hmm. This building, as it was told, God, I hate how confuddled this has become by media reports and everything, but if you were to believe the stories of the time and the exaggerated stories since then, this murder castle was designed to kill and torture and torment victims with a whole new level of sadistic intent. What also muddles our understanding of what was actually in this structure is that he had hired multiple construction crews to do the work throughout the process. So reportedly, so that no one would know the true and final layout of the building. But you know what he also liked to do? Hire people and then not pay for the labor, as con men do. So it's very likely that he would need multiple crews, because if you get halfway through a job and you haven't seen a check, you quit, and then he's going to hire someone else. So it could be a twofold thing here. Was he hiding what he was building, or did people just say, like, bro, we ain't working for free. We're done. We're out. Bye. That may have also slowed some of the process. It took them quite a while. He started building in 1889, and it took at least 2 years to build, which meant that it was ready in time for a very special something that would be opening in May of 1893. Which, I hate to say, well, we did a whole episode on, if you want to learn more about the Chicago World's Fair, Well, actually, it would have opened in 92 because it was the 400-year anniversary of Columbus in 1492. No, because they set sail in 1492, docked in 1493. But yes, Chicago World Fair, amazing. I want it to happen again, minus the horrible racism and colonialism, which you kind of can't escape in America history at this point, so yay. But the construction happened in tiers almost. The third floor would have been added in 1892. Officially, it may have never been open to the general public, and may have been mostly his story, like, oh, I'm building this hotel and everyone should get involved. He might have been money scheming with it, trying to get investors, etc., etc., just laundering money through the construction process, etc., etc. But we do know for a fact that this building was functional. Whether or not it was being used as a hotel in the top floor is an entirely different, like, discussion. The bottom two floors contained stores and spaces for long-term rentals, which tells us that whatever was going on here was not loud or noticeable enough for people to, like, leave their rentals, which is saying something. Like, you rent a store somewhere, you kind of you stick around for a while, and they didn't seem to have a ton of in and out on it. But the top floor is supposedly the grand renovations where people would be able to stay. If you are to believe, I say this very, very exaggeratedly, if you are to believe what the papers wrote, what our current perception of the murder castle is, it would include details of doors that locked from the outside, doorways that led nowhere, secret passageways, stairwells that take you absolutely nowhere or drop you out the side of a building, or even hidden trap doors and chutes that would drop you straight into the basement, rooms that were connected to gas lines that would allow him to choke his victims, soundproofing on the walls to hide their horrendous screams of people being murdered, peepholes so that he could watch into his guests, and a bunch of other terrifying concepts straight out of the Boogeyman Dracula handbook. Yep. Now, some of this could have very well been there. Chutes to a basement sound an awful lot like laundry chutes that would have existed in most hotels or buildings or the like, or large buildings anywhere where staircases in this time period are incredibly dangerous to go up and down because they are very narrow, very thin. Women are carrying baskets of laundry, food, and long skirts. A lot of buildings actually had either some sort of disposal chute or laundry chute to aid in the work of the household. So, like, I can't say that this was or was not there, but the idea that it was all built just for murder is a kind of promoted media concept. But if the stories were to be believed, there would be room for over 100 people that could have stayed in that hotel waiting for their death. But it was never, as far as we know, really even technically open to the public. The basement was said to have some sort of lab in it, that there was space for experimentation and disposal of bodies. It was almost you could call it medical almost because of the scientific equipment in there, which would have been essentially a dissection table. But if there was a stretching rack in there, as story goes, then yes, it would have qualified as a, like, you know, torture room, etc., etc. And stories say that there were multiple methods of disposal, including acid pits that you could dissolve a body into. A body chute, yes. That he could have sold the cadavers and made them unidentifiable by the dissections he had done and pulling flesh from the skeletons, or a kiln that he was using as a cremation kind of system. But, I mean, I'm trying to think of, like, vats of acid in a Victorian building.
Yeah, no.
I feel like this would have been
Also, where's he sourcing his acid?
Yeah. Like, there's only so many antacid tablets a pharmacist can get a hold of.
Right, yeah. I know that, like, you know, the hat cleaning stuff was...
Like arsenic and all that, but, yeah. Yeah, no.
I mean, you know, who knows?
Yeah, who knows? You know, maybe he was making Costco-sized orders of his pharmaceuticals and...
He's buying them in bulk from the acid store.
Yeah.
No one's like...
He sells it more belladonna than anyone in the city. Or aqua tofana, sorry. Yeah, so that's kind of like the murder castle as it would be portrayed in the public. Uh-huh. Yeah. And he could have gathered his victims in a myriad of ways. He could have waited for them to check into his hotel again. We never knew if it even housed people in the top floor. He could have advertised it as a safe place for women to work and for them to find employment. It could have been an advertisement that he was looking for a new wife, even. I mean, people posted classifieds saying, like, man in search of wife must be able to haul this much grain up a staircase. Like, like, you know?
I like my women sturdy.
Yeah.
I want
to
put it in a newspaper.
I mean, it's very, like, almost Western, because, like, there were so many, out during westward expansion, like, yeah. Man seeking wife, yeah, must be amenable to traveling the Oregon, yeah, Trail, like, yeah, you know, crazy stuff, yeah. But this is the that idea that he would have, like, listed a classified looking for a wife wouldn't have been far off for a con man. Because you can go out and take the time to woo a woman on your own, or you can just put it in the newspaper.
Yeah.
Sorry, I love it. It's very cute.
But it's just her sliding on the floor.
Yeah, she loves that. She'll give herself a concussion if I let her use her little...
Sorry, that's me. I should stop.
No, it's cute. It's fine. Now she's sitting in her bed. You can just drag her around like that.
Surfboard.
So during this supposed murder arc of his time, he was continuing with his insurance scams. Not all of them were life insurance policies. But keep in mind that the name Benjamin Pitezel, I believe it's pronounced, that'll come up important later. But he's kind of in a couple cons with him. And I'm shocked that at this point, none of the insurance people were like, hey, we've cashed a lot of insurance policies for you. We've got a lot of this and this. We've noticed this. He might have been sourcing from multiple insurance agencies, but, like, bro, you're going to tell me that you're just giving this guy, like, thousands of dollars for people that keep, like, dying, yeah, or whatever?
They're like, wow, this guy must have been so loved by his community.
Yeah, mm-hmm, really. So, for, like, the fraud comes through life insurance, yes, but also just deals on his building. I'm not sure if he was doing it on, like, the tenant level, like, hey, I didn't get your check in the mail, send me 500 more bucks. But we do know that, like, the builders of the building, even the people that supplied, like, the furniture contracts and stuff, were defrauded to some extent. There was one supposed, again, I say supposed because, yeah, with a story like this, I want to lay eyes on the primary documents, and yeah, I can't. So I'm just saying it all with a grain of salt. That there was a janitor who later kind of fessed up that Holmes knew that he had defrauded the furniture salesman and was not going to deliver any money. And that the furniture guys were like, okay, we'll come and repo all of our furniture back. You can't have a hotel without the furniture, so we'll take it all back. And they show up to take all the furniture, and there's none in the building. And the janitor says, supposedly, that Holmes put all the furniture into a room, closed the door, and then walled over the door. Yeah, and that was my reaction too. I was like, huh, smart, but also, like,
I mean,
it gets it done, I guess.
Man is nothing if not creative.
Yeah, exactly. So if we were looking at a time in which the volume of his murders was highest, we're probably looking at the Chicago World's Fair or the World's Columbian Exposition, which you can go back and listen to my episode a couple of weeks ago. Self-shameless plug there.
Yeah.
If you don't have the time to go back and listen to the full episode, rest assured, this sees a huge influx of millions of people all over the world coming to see it. And that is the perfect opportunity to... if he was convincing people to stay in the hotel, possibly, or maybe he was looking to woo specific women who he saw as gullible or vulnerable, there were plenty of them. Even if, you know, the majority of women would have been expected to be accompanied by a man, there was a whole women's exposition at this fair.
Yeah.
It would have drawn women maybe in a small pack, like how girls go to the bathroom, you know? But now I expect everyone to be a serial killer, so I always go to the bathroom with my girlfriends, and I never go anywhere without them. So, you know, don't catch me standing alone in public. But it would have been easier to isolate women in a situation like that, that's busy, that if someone went missing, there's like someone back in California who's like, hey, my sister traveled to Chicago for the World's Fair to see it. I haven't seen her in 6 months. I know it takes a letter, like 2 weeks to get back here at least, but like, hey, I should have seen her or heard from her by now. And then there's about 100 bus or train stops and hotels and places she could have gone missing along the way. So it's just a lot easier to get away with things in the chaos of this. His MO is that he would find women to kind of woo. Whether that be offering engagement or employment, it's not clear, but he would do something that would allow him access to their life savings and property and oftentimes life insurance policy. And I find that really interesting because he went for vulnerable women, albeit pretty wealthy ones, if our suspicions about who he killed is correct. But women often didn't have as much property as men. But it's easier to take advantage of them. So he kind of went for the safer, more discreet route for a lower payout rather than trying to like defraud a huge millionaire businessman and sell him the Eiffel Tower, you know? Like, yeah. Victor. I just find it very interesting. Yeah, Victor. Yeah. I just find it very interesting that he was a con man and he was playing it almost relatively safe, but he had no qualms, it seemed, about killing people to do it. But for a man who's already married at least twice, involved in so many cons, and constantly lying, what does that tell us about him as a person? And this becomes almost criminal profiling. It tells us that he has to have been pretty dang charismatic. The women that he targeted and successfully victimized were often wealthy and beautiful. So to kind of be in their league, to warrant their affections, he had to be very debonair or handsome, or had to be able to lie about his own wealth pretty effectively in order to pull it off. So later a past employee noted that indeed almost no one could pull off, like almost no one in the world could have pulled off the type of stuff that he was doing, but he was just so dang charismatic that he was probably the only person in the world that could have done it. So that tells you a lot about H.H. Holmes. And he, again, has been pulling off cons and stuff since he was in, like, college. Mm-hmm. He's been doing this for a while, whether it be selling cadavers or killing women for their life insurance policies. He's no stranger to it. This does not stop him from getting married again, this time to Georgiana Yoke in 1894. Bless you, Mouse. And he, again, did it with such charisma that no one's like, ah, remember that dude? He's already married. He's getting married again. Everyone's just like, ah, yes. So if he wanted to double down on profits, again, this is not a known entity because we don't have, like, he did not record keep on the amount of bodies he sold or anything like that. But if he wanted to, he could have collected a life insurance policy on someone and then doubled his profits by just being like, hey, you want a body? Like, does any medical college need a body? And he'd be making 2 times the money on one person. He may have cremated them. He may have buried them. But we do know that later a couple bodies were found buried. So maybe if he only killed a couple people, maybe that's really all they were. And he never had to cremate anything or sell anything. And he just buried them. Maybe he felt guilty about it and didn't want to burn them. And I was like, ah, I already put them through enough. I'll just bury them here. Like, there's so many unknowns when you're dealing with such misconstrued and warped data. If there was really the claims, oh my god, Mouse, now, the claims that like hundreds of people were killed by H.H. Holmes, we'll get into that claim later in the historiography of it and where it originates, but it's hard to think that if even during the chaos of the Chicago World's Fair, that if hundreds of people were going into a murder hotel and not coming out, that no one would have noticed. Right. There were still businesses, there were still locals around here who could have caught something, who would have noticed a smell, or may have noticed, you know, people's personal effects piling up. Yeah. Or like at some point, if I was to say, I'm going to try to kill 100 people off the street, odds are that one or two of them were with a group or someone would have noticed them missing. Yeah. Yeah. Which also tells us that the number is probably not as high as we would have expected. And it's really hard because, like, there's also this narrative created about H.H. Holmes in the Chicago World Fair and the murders, and it all being this big hullabaloo where he was just mass murdering people. And to find out that, like, that's not certifiably true is kind of disillusioning, because it's like, that's part of the... My God, Mouse is being a chaos gremlin. She does, and she also learned recently that if she holds something in her mouth and just throws her head back and forth, eventually the ball will fly away and she gets to play fetch with herself. Well, we can play with her in a sec, but because we're about to hit my little break into part two, but it doesn't help that when the Chicago World Fair is over, no matter how many murders he has or has not committed to this point, Chicago is going to see a change in its economy. It's going to see a bit of a downturn. And Holmes sort of moves on to more lucrative pursuits. And this is where we start to see him really pick on some riskier business and possibly some more insurance fraud, but also just some other general cons and thefts. And that is going to lead to him getting caught, which is where we will pick up next week in part two of H.H. Holmes. And I know that we...
Okay, my mic's back. So
we had that little brief flip there, but we wanted to hop back, both of us, on to close out,
finish up.
Yeah,
this was a very, very, very good cat. I'm so excited, and I know we've talked about Holmes for a long time.
Yeah,
so I'm glad we're finally.
There's a lot of conjecture there, but yeah,
I mean it's good, and it's part of why we do this, because there's a lot of history that's like that you know, unless you take the time to look into it and and figure out, like, was that real, then you would just never know.
Exactly.
And we would just keep on going, like, oh yeah, that lady, she killed 600 people.
Yeah. And even if it doesn't, I can't tell you the exact story of what did happen. No one can. And it's important for us to know that we can't tell each other exactly what happened. Yep. So we'll be back with the rest of that story next week. I will be starting out with part two of that first. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Cal has a plan for...
I do.
Oh, you do.
I do.
Okay.
Well,
do you want to keep it a secret?
If I can pull it off.
Okay.
Yes, I won't say it yet because I don't know if it's going to be enough for like an episode. But if it's enough content, then yes, I have an idea, and you should look forward to it because I'm looking forward to it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, if there is something else you ever want from us, whether it be a theme episode or just a general episode, we are in the middle of Women's History Month, I believe, by the time this is released.
Yes.
We are a little out of order, so our theme or our month might get a little mixed up, but we're always okay to talk about pretty much anything, anytime. So just let us know by tweeting at us at TINAHL podcast.
Or you can email us at thisisnotahistorylecture@gmail.com.
We always appreciate your feedback, and every review you leave is...
one more bit of chaos that Mouse gets to commit.
Yeah, we're taking bets over here on how old she actually is, because we're both pretty sure.
We're pretty sure she's bigger than she used to be.
And that
she's grown.
The Humane Society gave me their best bet when they did an intake.
And it's never really accurate.
Yeah, they did it based on her teeth, I think, but she's gotten bigger. I know she had to be.
Yeah.
And her butt is fluffier, so she's definitely growing into her corginess.
She's hitting puberty.
Yeah.
She's getting those feminine features. Yeah.
The Disney anthropomorphized figures.
Mouse skinny.
Anyway, we are always happy to hear from y'all. So just remember to tune back in for the rest of the story next week. And remember that in the meantime, this has not been
a history
lecture.
Bye. Bye.